This program is provided by lawyer Kyungjin Kim.
Imagine you're building a multi-million dollar software company. You launch your flagship product, user adoption is just off the charts, and you're scaling globally.
Right.
Then, you know, you wake up one morning to find out the European Union has legally reclassified your entire company as a high-risk entity.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You're suddenly facing these massive fines, mandatory external audits, and just endless compliance paperwork. And it's all because of a single enthusiastic sentence buried in your marketing brochure.
I mean, it sounds like a tech founder's absolute nightmare, but under the new regulatory frameworks being built right now, it is a very real possibility.
Exactly. And that is the tension we're exploring in today's deep dive. We are welcoming you, whether you're a developer writing code, a startup founder pitching investors, or just, you know, an insanely curious observer of the global tech landscape.
Yeah, we're navigating the brand new, highly complex rulebook the European Union is currently writing for artificial intelligence.
Right. Our specific mission today is figuring out exactly how the EU is deciding what makes an AI system high risk. Because that label, it just changes absolutely everything about how a company operates.
It really does. It's the single most important threshold question for anyone touching AI in the European market right now.
Yep.
I mean, crossing that line triggers a complete regulatory avalanche.
So to help us map this uncharted territory, we're relying on a specialized report and commentary provided by lawyer Kyungjin Kim, a former lawmaker.
Right.
His notes break down this highly technical, foundational document, and our focus today is exclusively on the general principles section of the draft commission guidelines on high-risk AI classification under Article 6 of the EU AI Act.
Very important document.
But before we get into the weeds, I need to look you, the listener, right in the eye and make something forcefully, unequivocally clear. The document lawyer Kyungjin Kim is analyzing is a non-binding draft.
Exactly, non-binding.
It is a text intended purely for stakeholder consultation. It is not finalized, enforceable law yet. And ultimately, no matter what guidance the European Commission publishes, the absolute final word on how to interpret the AI Act always belongs to the Court of Justice of the European Union, the CJEU.
Yeah, that context is vital. We're essentially reviewing the architectural blueprints while the foundation is, you know, still being dug.
Right.
But to even understand those blueprints, we have to look at the site itself. The broader EU AI Act has actually been in effect since August 1, 2024.
Which is pretty recent.
Yeah. And the whole philosophy driving it is this massive, delicate balancing act. Like, the EU is trying to foster technological innovation and economic growth while simultaneously fulfilling their primary mandate.
Which is protecting health and safety, right?
Health, safety, and fundamental rights, which, under their definition, explicitly includes safeguarding democracy and the rule of law.
So they're trying to thread that needle using a risk-based approach, which, I mean, it sounds logical on paper, but as we'll see, the execution is incredibly complicated.
Right, because they are deliberately choosing not to regulate the technology as a monolith.
Okay.
Instead, they're regulating the specific risk that a specific technology poses in a specific context. They're basically sorting AI into different buckets based on the potential harm it could cause to a citizen's life, liberty, or safety.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because before we can even begin to label an AI system as high risk and, you know, throw it into that heavily regulated bucket, we have to ask a surprisingly tricky foundational question.
Yeah.
Is the software we are looking at even considered an AI system under the eyes of the law? We have to move from these grand political goals of protecting democracy to exact granular legal definitions.
Right.
So how does the EU actually define AI?
Well, the guidelines refer directly to Article 3, Section 1 of the AI Act to answer that.
Yeah.
And it's a surprisingly strict set of criteria.
Yep.
To be legally considered an AI system, the software has to meet four specific conditions.
Break them down for me.
First, it has to be a machine-based system. Second, it must be designed to operate with varying levels of autonomy.
Autonomy, got it.
Third, it must potentially exhibit adaptability after deployment. And fourth, and this is really where most traditional software gets filtered out, it must infer how to generate outputs from the inputs it receives.
Wait, let me stop you there. Because when you say a system infers how to generate outputs based on inputs, I mean, you're describing almost every piece of software on my laptop.
Well, not exactly.
Like, if I type a formula into a spreadsheet, it generates an output based on my input. Is Microsoft Excel suddenly classified as AI under European law? I think we need a really clear dividing line here for you, the listener.
That's fair.
Let's look at a high-stakes scenario. Traditional tax calculation software versus an experimental medical imaging tool.
Okay, that is the perfect contrast to illustrate the legal threshold. Take the tax software, You input your income, your deductions, and the software spits out exactly what you owe.
Right.
It generates an output from an input, yes, but it is entirely rule-based.
Ah, I see.
A human programmer wrote a deterministic script, like if income is X, apply tax rate Y. The system is not learning anything new about tax law.
It's just following instructions.
Exactly. It's not inferring relationships that weren't explicitly coded into it. Therefore, under the EU AI Act, it is not an AI system.
Okay, so the human is still fully driving the logic. Now, what about the medical imaging tool?
Well, let's say you feed that medical software thousands of MRI scans. The programmers didn't write a rule that says, if a cluster of pixels looks exactly like this shape, flag it as a tumor.
Right.
Instead, the system analyzes the vast data set, recognizes novel, subtle patterns in tissue density that a human doctor might miss, and it builds its own internal statistical model to identify anomalies.
Wow.
Yeah, it is inferring the rules for diagnosis based on the data environment. Furthermore, as it processes more scans in the real world, it adapts its parameters to become more accurate.
Oh, the adaptability part.
Exactly. That adaptability and inference push it firmly over the legal threshold.
So the trigger isn't automation, it's the machine's ability to build its own internal logic to solve a problem.
Yes. The guidelines explicitly clarify that basic automated decision-making systems or simple rule-based algorithms, they just do not fall under the AI Act.
Good to know.
If the software doesn't meet the legal definition of autonomy, adaptability, and inference, the AI Act ignores it entirely.
All right, so we've established the baseline. We know what actually qualifies as an AI system. Now we hit the main event of lawyer Kung-Jin Kim's analysis.
Yeah.
How does the EU decide which of those true AI systems are dangerous enough to get slapped with the high-risk label? Because obviously, a machine learning algorithm recommending a Spotify playlist is very different from an algorithm deciding who gets a mortgage.
Definitely. What's fascinating here is the draft guidelines detail two very distinct regulatory paths or scenarios under Article 6 that trigger a high-risk classification.
Walk us through the first path.
So the first scenario falls under what is known as Annex M, and this path is entirely about physical product safety.
Physical safety, okay.
Yeah, if an AI system is used as a safety component within a product that is already regulated by existing union harmonization legislation, or if the AI system is the product itself, it is deemed high risk.
Okay, union harmonization legislation sounds like incredibly dense bureaucratic jargon.
It really does.
What does that actually mean for a developer?
It basically means the EU already has a massive catalog of strict safety rules for physical goods sold in their market. Think about medical devices, aviation security equipment, toys, or heavy industrial machinery.
Right.
To sell those items in Europe, you typically need what's called a third-party conformity assessment. You have to hire an independent, state-recognized auditor to inspect your product, test it, and stamp it as safe.
Like getting a building inspector to sign off on a new elevator.
Precisely. So, under Annex A, if your elevator relies on a new AI component to manage its emergency braking system, and the elevator as a whole requires that independent safety audit, then your AI component is automatically classified as high risk.
I get it.
The EU is simply bridging their new digital laws with their existing physical safety laws.
That feels logical, actually. You don't want a beta testing algorithm controlling a physical emergency brake.
No, you definitely do not.
So what is the second path to being classified as high risk?
The second path is outlined in Annex 3. And this is where things get much more complex because it deals with specific use cases rather than physical products.
Use cases, okay.
The EU has drawn up an explicit list of domains where they believe the mere application of AI poses an inherent threat to fundamental human rights. If your AI operates in one of these specific areas, Article 6, Section 2 automatically triggers the high-risk classification.
What kind of use cases are we talking about here?
The list includes areas like biometric identification and categorization of natural persons. It includes the management and operation of critical infrastructure like water or electricity grids.
That makes sense.
It also covers AI used in education-like systems, deciding university admissions, and AI used in employment, like automated resume screeners. It also heavily restricts AI used by law enforcement, border control, or in the administration of justice.
I want to pause here just to make sure you, as our listener, understand the gravity of this. Falling into either Annex A or Annex 3 is not just a semantic label.
Not at all.
It fundamentally alters your business model. If you are a high-risk provider, you face an incredibly burdensome set of strict requirements.
Huge requirements.
You have to implement mandatory continuous risk management systems. You have to prove the high quality and lack of bias in your training data through intense governance structures.
Right.
You need exhaustively detailed technical documentation, guaranteed human oversight mechanisms, and certified standards for accuracy and cybersecurity. You can't just move fast and break things anymore.
No.
You have to prove definitively that your system is safe and trustworthy before you are legally allowed to launch it.
The compliance hurdle is astronomically high, both in terms of financial cost and engineering resources. And because that burden is so heavy, companies are naturally, inevitably, going to look for clever ways to maneuver around it.
Which brings us to perhaps the most fascinating concept in lawyer Kinjin Kim's notes, the battle over intended purpose.
Yes.
Because if I'm a tech executive and I know that building a high-risk AI means I have to spend millions on compliance and open myself up to massive legal liability, my first instinct is to play a semantic game.
Exactly.
I'll just tell the regulators, hey, we built this powerful tool, but it was never intended to be used for high-risk activities. If an employer decides to use our text generator to screen resumes, that's their problem, not ours.
And that is exactly the evasion tactic the draft guidelines are engineered to shut down. Under the EU AI Act, intended purpose isn't just an abstract philosophy or a casual claim made in a boardroom. No. Under Article 3, Section 12, it is a rigidly defined legal construct.
Yeah.
The intended purpose is determined objectively by what the provider explicitly communicates in their instructions for use, their promotional materials, their public sales statements, and their internal technical documentation.
So it's tied to what they say it does.
Right. It is the specific context and conditions of use that the provider actively sets out.
I see where this is going, but we need to draw a distinction. What if a user just completely misuses a tool? Let's ditch the tired legal analogy about hammers and paperweights and talk about actual software.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say I build a sophisticated, friendly language model specifically marketed and designed to act as a customer service chatbot for retail websites.
Sure.
But a malicious user figures out how to jailbreak my model and trick it into writing highly persuasive phishing emails to steal people's passwords. Am I suddenly a high-risk cybersecurity threat provider?
No. And the guidelines draw a very sharp line here. What you just described is what the Act calls reasonably foreseeable misuse.
Misuse.
Right. The system was clearly designed, documented, and marketed for customer service. The user actively subverted the system's safeguards to do something else. The EU regulates based on the intended purpose you designed it for, not the hostile misuse by a bad actor.
Okay, so that protects the developer from rogue users. But here's where it gets really interesting, especially regarding general purpose AI. Let me pitch you a much more ambiguous scenario.
Go for it.
Let's say I build a massive, highly capable foundational model. In my global marketing campaign, I boast about its versatility. I say, this AI can write Python code, analyze complex data sets, read human emotions from text. It can do almost anything.
Right, the typical marketing pitch.
Exactly. I want everyone to buy it. But to shield my company from EU regulators, I have my lawyers bury a single sentence deep in the terms of service that says, disclaimer, do not use this system for high-risk activities as defined by Annex 3rd of the EU AI Act. Have I successfully shielded myself from the compliance burden?
Absolutely not. The regulators have anticipated this exact terms of service loophole, and the draft guidelines explicitly crush it.
Wow, really?
Yeah. A simple disclaimer hidden in the fine print is entirely legally insufficient if it contradicts the reality of the product.
So the EU regulators are going to look past the legal boilerplate.
They are going to look at the totality of your product's presence. They will analyze your marketing positioning, the overall presentation to the public, and crucially, the actual demonstrated capabilities of the system.
So it's not just the fine print.
Right. If your marketing loudly implies the AI can be seamlessly integrated across a broad range of corporate contexts, and the tool's capabilities realistically encourage or facilitate high-risk uses like human resources screening,
yeah,
then legally, your intended purpose includes those high-risk uses.
Wait. So if I build a versatile Swiss Army knife of an AI and I know it can sort job applicants, I can't just wink at the consumer, hand them the tool, and then legally wash my hands of what they do with it.
You cannot. If a high-risk use is technically feasible and reasonably foreseeable, given how you have positioned the system's capabilities, you are on the hook as a high-risk provider.
That's mad.
It is. If a company truly wants to avoid that classification for a versatile system, their limitations must be glaringly clear, highly specific, and consistently communicated across all materials.
Like everywhere.
Yes, from the front page of the marketing website to the deepest technical documentation. And the burden of this self-assessment lies entirely on the AI provider.
Okay, so they have to do the homework and take the liability. But what happens once the AI leaves the original provider's hands?
That's a great question.
Let's talk about the value chain, because this is how the modern tech industry actually operates. Most companies aren't training massive foundational models from scratch.
No, they're not.
They're buying access to existing APIs, tweaking them, and building specialized applications on top. If the original creator is responsible for setting the intended purpose, what happens when someone else enters the picture and changes the context?
This is one of the most critical shifts in the entire regulatory landscape. Under Article 25, third parties, which includes distributors, importers, or the deployers who actually use the system, can suddenly find themselves legally transformed into a provider.
Meaning a small downstream company suddenly inherits the massive compliance burden of a tech giant. That sounds terrifying for a startup.
It is a massive shift in liability. The guidelines outline three specific situations where this responsibility forcibly transfers down the value chain.
Okay, what's number one?
Number one, the third party puts their own name or trademark on a high-risk AI system that is already on the market.
That is wild. So if the three-person startup licenses a high-risk open-source model, doesn't change a single line of code, but puts their own startup logo on the dashboard and sells it to a hospital,
yep.
The EU treats that three-person startup as the legal provider of a high-risk medical device.
Yes. The moment you white-label it and present it under your brand, you assume the legal responsibility for its compliance.
Wow.
The EU wants accountability at the point of commercialization.
Okay, what's the second situation?
Number two, a third party substantially modifies an existing high-risk AI system in a way that it remains a high-risk system.
Meaning?
If you take a high-risk engine and tinker with its core mechanics, it is legally your engine now. You have to recertify it.
So if you break the seal, you buy the liability. What's the third situation?
The third situation is perhaps the trickiest trap for developers. This happens when a third party takes an AI system that was not originally classified as high-risk, but they change its intended purpose so that it now operates in an Annex or Annex 3 high-risk category.
Let me make sure I understand. If I take a completely benign, low-risk chatbot designed to recommend recipes,
okay,
but I aggressively retrain it and integrate it into a hospital's emergency room triage system,
yeah,
to prioritize patient care. I mean, I have changed the intended purpose to a high-risk health scenario.
Exactly. The original creator built a recipe bot. They are not liable. You created a medical triage bot. Under Article 25, you are now the provider of a high-risk AI system, and you must generate all the compliance documentation from scratch. You cannot pass the legal buck back up the supply chain to the original developer.
That is a staggering reality check for the entire wrapper economy of startups building on top of existing models.
It really is.
So with all these complex rules, the massive financial burdens, and these shifting liabilities hiding in the value chain, when does the hammer actually fall? Reading through lawyer Kungjin Kim's notes, the compliance timeline seems incredibly convoluted. When do companies need to have all this paperwork finished?
The timelines have indeed been a moving target. Originally, the compliance dates were strictly tethered to the date the AI Act entered into force.
Okay.
However, the guidelines outline several significant timeline shifts introduced by what is known as the AI Omnibus.
What exactly is the AI Omnibus?
It was a legislative package designed to amend several existing EU directives simultaneously. In this context, it essentially acted as a delay mechanism, pushing the application dates back to give the tech industry and the regulators a bit more breathing room to prepare.
So what are the hard deadlines now?
Well, for the specific use cases outlined in Annex 3rd, things like biometric identification or law enforcement, the compliance deadline was pushed from August 2, 2026 to December 2, 2027.
Okay, 2027.
And for the Annex I safety components, the AI embedded in physical products like machinery or medical devices, that deadline was pushed from August 2, 2027, all the way to August 2, 2028.
Okay, so we're looking at late 2027 and 2028 for new systems. But what about the millions of AI systems that are already operating right now? Are they suddenly illegal on those dates if they don't halt operations and complete a massive audit?
No. The EU recognized that would cause catastrophic market instability. This brings us to the grandfathering clause.
Grandfather.
Generally speaking, if a high-risk AI system was already placed on the market or put into service before August 2, 2026, it is grandfathered in. it does not immediately need to comply with the new rules.
That's a huge relief for legacy systems, but I imagine there's a catch.
There's always a catch. The catch is that the grandfathering only lasts as long as the system remains fundamentally the same.
What does that mean exactly?
If that existing system undergoes a significant change in design, meaning a major architectural update or a fundamental shift in its core capabilities, it loses its grandfathered status and instantly triggers the new compliance rules.
So routine bug fixes are fine, but if you push a massive generational update to your model, you wake up the regulators.
Correct. Furthermore, lawyer Kunjin Kim highlights two major exceptions where the grandfathering clause eventually expires, regardless of design changes.
What's the first one?
First, if the high-risk AI system is intended for use by public authorities, providers and deployers of governance systems must achieve full compliance by August 2, 2030, no matter what.
That makes total sense from a civil liberties perspective. The EU can't allow outdated, potentially biased algorithms to be used by police or welfare agencies indefinitely just because they're old.
Exactly.
What is the second exception?
The second exception targets large-scale IT systems established by specific legal acts, which are listed in Annex X of the AI Act.
Like what?
We are talking about massive, deeply entrenched EU databases used for international border control, customs, or cross-border law enforcement. Because overhauling those sprawling legacy systems is a logistical nightmare, they have been given the longest runway. They must achieve compliance by December 31st, 2030.
So everyone gets a runway, but every runway eventually ends.
It does. And if we connect all these granular details to the broader picture of technology governance,
yeah,
it's crucial to recognize that the EU knows AI is evolving much faster than traditional legislative processes.
True.
The AI Act is deliberately designed not to be a static historical document.
How do they future-proof a law against a technology that changes every 6 months?
Through continuous institutional support and built-in legal flexibility. The newly formed AI office is tasked with constantly issuing updated guidance. More importantly, the European Commission retains the power to adopt what are called delegated acts.
Think of a delegated act like a software patch for the law itself.
Exactly right. It allows the Commission to bypass the years-long process of drafting a new law and instead quickly add, modify, or delete specific high-risk use cases from Annex III on an annual basis.
Oh, that's smart.
As new risks emerge or as certain technologies become safer, the law can be patched to reflect the current market reality.
It is a living regulation for a living technology. As we wrap up this deep dive into the insights provided by lawyer Kunjin Kim, I want to synthesize the core narrative for you, our listeners.
Yeah, let's bring it all together.
What we are seeing here isn't just a dry list of technical specifications. The EU is weaving a highly sophisticated, comprehensive regulatory net. And the most shocking part is that this net catches AI not just by analyzing its underlying source code or its mathematical weights. It catches AI by intensely scrutinizing human behavior, how the tech is marketed in brochures, how its intended purpose is described on a website, how it is modified downstream by third parties, and crucially, whose brand name is slapped on the final dashboard.
That's so true.
They are regulating the entire commercial life cycle and the public presentation of the technology to gauge its true risk to society.
It is a radically holistic approach to regulation.
Yeah.
And sitting with that reality raises a deeply provocative question for the future of the global tech industry.
Lay it on us.
If an AI system's legal risk classification in the European Union is dictated so heavily by its marketing copy, its product positioning, and the sweeping claims made by its sales team, how will this completely reshape the way global technology companies communicate with the public?
Yeah, because the internet doesn't stop at the borders of the EU.
Exactly. Will a cutting-edge startup in Silicon Valley or a massive conglomerate in Tokyo have to completely sanitize their global marketing campaigns? Will they have to deliberately downplay the capabilities of their AI, terrified that an overly enthusiastic sales pitch will accidentally trigger a high-risk classification and millions of dollars in compliance costs in Europe?
Right.
Will the fear of falling into this regulatory bucket fundamentally chill how we talk about and perhaps even how we fund AI innovation on a global scale?
That is a fascinating, slightly unsettling final thought. We started this conversation talking about blueprints and building codes for physical structures. But unlike an apartment building, which stays exactly where you built it under local laws, an AI system and the marketing website surrounding it lives instantly and globally.
Very true.
The EU is writing a local building code, but the sheer weight of their market might force the whole world to change how they design their digital foundations just to pass the inspection.
Very possible.
It is something you should absolutely keep an eye on the next time a major tech company launches a new do-everything AI model. Watch how carefully the executives choose their words on stage. They aren't just pitching to you, they are defending themselves against regulators an ocean away. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive, and as always, keep questioning the information around you.
This program is provided by Lawyer Kyungjin Kim.